Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for February's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in small animal surgery, Scott Rutherford. Thank you, Scott. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for attending this afternoon's presentation. Today, we're going to talk about angular limb deformities, which is a huge topic and something that we can't really cover in just 1 hour. But the hope is that at the end of the presentation that you'll understand a little bit about what goes into the investigation and the treatment of these complex deformities. Angular limb deformities are actually quite common. People always think about the little dogs with bent front legs, but one of the most common presentations of angular limb deformity is patellar luxation. Patellar luxation often comes about because of an angular deformity in the limb, and it's something that we see every day. No matter how these deformities present, we approach them in a similar way, in an organised way, and that allows us to have a better idea of what's going on. There's a wide variety of diseases that can affect bone growth. Hormonal disease, so disruptions in growth hormone, thyroid hormone, the steroid hormones can have effect. Congenital disease, where we have the patellar luxation. Here we have a retained cartilaginous core. There's nutritional disease that will affect bone growth. If we have rickets, hyperparathyroidism, etc., all of these can affect bone growth. Metabolic disease, traumatic. So that would be end up being one of the more common presentations now, is if we have trauma to the growth plates or the metaphysis epiphysis close to those growth plates. What happens with these bone diseases is that they affect chondrogenesis, the formation of cartilage, and then cartilage transformation, and then bone formation, so ossification. And they'll often lead to premature closure of the physis, the growth plates. And not always, but that could lead to angular or rotational deformities. What happens is that angular limb deformities can induce a functional problem if that deformity is greater than the animal's ability to compensate. So many, many diseases end up causing an abnormality in the bone, but that doesn't necessarily correlate to clinical signs. Okay. You have to have, the deformity has to be greater than that individual animal's ability to compensate. Most of these deformities will shorten the limb, but animals have a remarkable ability to compensate. They will deal with bones that are 20% shorter, up to 20% shorter than the normal mature bone before that leads to any problem. If it's greater than this, then it will lead to lameness, the gait alteration. One of the biggest problems of angular limb deformities is the abnormal stresses and strains it puts on the adjacent joints. And we will often see that leads to degenerative joint disease over time. And that's often where the difficulty comes with these, because we've got to make a clinical judgment as to what the problem, how much of a problem that angular limb deformity will cause that patient for the rest of its life. Two, as we said before, the two main reasons for the angular limb deformities that we'll talk about today are premature arrest of long bone growth, and that becomes a bigger problem when you have a paired bone, as in the radius and ulna here. One of the most common reasons for an angular limb deformity is premature closure of the distal ulnar physis. And because these bones are in effect joined together by a very strong interosseous ligament, if they're not growing at the same rate, so if they have asynchronous growth, that will lead to the deformities that we can see here, like the radial procurvatum. And here you can see you have torsion of the bone. You've got a fairly straight elbow, it's not perfect, but you can see then you've almost got a medial lateral of the carpus. The other common thing that we'll see is malunion of a long bone fracture. So here we have a CT of a pelvic limb, and this dog had a distal tibial physeal fracture and a spiral that went up the diaphysis, and you've had a degree of pes varus here, so the foot is deviated medially, so you have a varus deformity here on the tibia. When we look at these animals, when they present to us, there's a number of factors that we have to consider. The animal's age is the most important. How much growth potential does that animal, that individual, have left? And that varies greatly between breeds of dog. Which bone is affected? As we just said, if it's a paired bone, if one bone of a paired bone system, so the radius or the ulna, or the tibia or the fibula, is affected, and the other bone is growing normally, then the bone that has reduced bone growth will act a bit like a bowstring. So it will never achieve the same length as the other one, and will have an effect by pulling on the other bone. If you have, you know, the femur affected, the effect of closure of a physis is less great, because the bone can compensate from the other end, the limb can compensate. So if the femur became shorter, maybe the tibia and the fibula, the metatarsals, will grow in excess to compensate. If the closure of the physis is complete or partial, so as we said, if you have a complete closure of a single bone unit, a complete closure of one of the physis of a single bone unit, that often won't actually have any detrimental effect on that individual. Whereas if you have a partial closure of a physis, then that will induce an angular limb deformity. A major consideration is what's happening to the joints proximal and distal to the affected bone. So is there joint subluxation? Because if you have subluxation of a joint, you're more likely to have the abnormal strains and stresses and get secondary osteoarthritis. And that's one of the major factors that we will consider as to whether an individual needs surgery or not. Is there limb shortening? As we said before, dogs have a remarkable ability to compensate with limb shortening. But if it gets to over 20% of the limb, expected limb alignment, or the contralateral limb, then that can induce lameness. Rotational deformity, so torsional deformity in bone, is often very, very significant. That can often be the biggest cause of lameness and gait alterations. But it can also be the hardest thing to actually assess. And then finally, is there angular deformity, either in the frontal plane or the sagittal plane? So dogs can cope with reasonable levels of angular deformity in the sagittal plane. So if you like, procurvatum, recurvatum, so a cranial bow or a caudal bow on bone, rather than a medial lateral deformity, so valgus or varus. So valgus and varus will often cause more of an abnormality in gait. The final thing to consider is the animal clinically affected? So many dogs have bent legs. You'll have seen them almost on a daily basis. So little Dachshunds, Shih Tzus, Lhasa Apso, etc. And these dogs have abnormal thoracic limbs, but of no clinical significance. So the most important thing is don't look at the bent leg, the cosmesis of it, the cosmetic effect. It's, is the dog clinically affected? Is it lame? Is it painful? As I said before, the age of the patient it becomes very important as to what we can do about the limb deformities. And if we roughly break dogs up into small, large, and giant breeds, okay, we take a small breed dog, we think of those as skeletally immature, okay, up until about 3 months of age. So that's when they've still got 2 or 3 months of growth potential. Okay, so that's very young. When that dog is over 4 months old, there is very little potential for growth. That's despite the physes not being closed. So these physes are open, the growth plates are open, but they will not grow very much. If you look at large breed dogs, we think of those, they're less than 5 or 6 months of age, they've still got growth potential. Over seven, there isn't very little. Greyhounds have been looked at this. And a greyhound has done 95% of its growth by the time it's 7 months of age. So very little extra growth after that. Giant breeds are obviously the longest. We think of those up to 7 or 8 months. But by the time they get over 8 months, again, they have little potential for ongoing growth. So how do we investigate these cases? Obviously, we take a complete history and a full exam. In the history, things that are quite important to question, if it's not something you would normally question in these cases, is what diet is the animal on? Okay, so fast growth, inadequate growth, diet, etc., can lead to nutritional or metabolic bone disease, or have a contribution to some of the congenital problems that could lead to angular limb deformities. Previous trauma is important, and it might be a previous trauma that was almost dismissed by the owner. It's not unusual for young puppies with an angular limb deformity. If you question the owner closely, you find out that there has been quite a severe lameness, but it didn't last very long. It was very transient. And a classic there is when you have distal ulnar physeal damage. So the dog goes very, very lame, but within days they're almost better, okay? And it's forgotten about in the owner's eyes. But what's happened is that the physis has been damaged, it's been crushed, it's been compressed, and growth is affected. And over the next month or two, you will see a limb deformity progress. Another one is if siblings are affected, is there a genetic component to this, to some of the congenital diseases? Then we go into the full examination, and you need to do a full physical exam and a full orthopedic exam. We don't need to go into that in too much detail. But it's important to look at the affected and the contralateral limb. So often, dogs are bilaterally affected, and then it's very difficult to compare. But if you have one limb that's affected, the other gives you a reference point as to what is normal for that individual. As I said before, a lot of our decisions are made on how clinically affected the dog is. So is there joint pain? Is there lameness? How is the dog doing? Don't just look at its bent leg. Assess the joint above and below where the deformity is, and really do analyze the analysis. You will have some idea from your gross examination of the animal where the deformity is, the angular component of it, the rotational component of it, and also limb length discrepancy. But that sometimes can be difficult to fully analyze. We'll then move on to imaging, which allows us to better quantify the deformity present, its location and magnitude, etc. So for this, we have two options, radiography or CT. Now, we will often use CT now because we will have better and more accurate results, and it allows us to go on to do some pretty neat, fancy work that we'll come on to in a short second. But if you are going to use radiographs, there's a few basic principles that you need to follow to get the radiographs right. It's very useful to do the affected and the unaffected limb. This allows us to quantify joint orientation, angles, etc. Okay, now I'll come on to discuss exactly what I mean by that a bit later. But if you have an unaffected limb, it allows us to quantify what's going on in the affected limb. You need to get whole bone, whole, well, in actual fact, whole limb if you can. The minimum you need are the joints proximal and distal. You cannot assess angular deformities if you don't have a reference point in proximal and distal, so you need the joints, and ideally as much of the adjacent bones as possible. So you see in this radiograph, we have an antebrachial deformity, but we've gone from the shoulder all the way, got the humerus and the antebrachium, the carpus, and a decent bit of the metacarpals as well. So that allows us to better analyze what's going on. When you position these radiographs, you want to position them so that the proximal joint is normal. Okay. So in this, we're looking at the elbow. Okay. Up here. Now this isn't quite perfect. It's very difficult sometimes in these dogs to get completely perfectly positioned radiographs, but it's important to strive. If you have a significantly rotated radiograph, we cannot assess what's going on, and specifically, we can't assess torsional deformities. So, in addition to having as much of the whole limb radiograph as you want to have radiographic projections that are centered on the joint in addition, okay? And that allows us to assess subluxation. When you take a radiograph, the only true image that you see is in the center of the radiograph. Everything else has a degree of magnification and a degree of the beam not coming straight down and perpendicular to what you're looking at. So if you want to properly assess joints, you have to have images centered on those, and again, orthogonal views. Okay, so if we are doing radiographs of a thoracic limb to assess an antebrachial deformity, you need as much of whole limb radiographs as you can, and that's two views, the mediolateral and the cranial caudal. Okay, and then you need the two views, orthogonal views of the elbow and the carpus. Right. If you are concerned about limb length discrepancy, what you can also do is you can radiograph the adjacent bones, and therefore you can measure the growth and compare it to the unaffected limb, if that is the case and that's what you've got. This becomes a lot more difficult if you have two affected limbs, even if one is worse than the other, because you don't actually have a normal joint to compare to. So we then move on to computed tomography. And that allows a much better assessment than radiographs. For all of the reasons that we talked about before, radiographs are unreliable for accurate assessment. So the CT allows us to make 3D reconstructions, and we can manipulate that software and move the bones around within the software so that we don't get radiographic positioning errors. In addition, CT allows 3D modeling of the limb. And as we can see in this image on the left. So when we've taken the CT, the data can be exported to a different CAD software. We can manipulate the software and we can print out that image, 3D print the image. And there's a two things that this allows us to do, okay? It allows us to pre-contour implants to the bone, as we've done here, which saves time in theatre, because these can be quite lengthy ops. But the other thing it allows us to do is actually a surgical rehearsal. But we can take the 3D model and we can actually practice the surgery, cut the bone, put the plates on, and assess that what we plan to do results in what we are aiming for. The other thing that we can do with computed tomography is do virtual surgery. So when we export the CT data into a CAD program, we can actually make virtual osteotomies and then reposition the bone in relation to each other exactly how we want, and to plan exactly the amount of angular correction or rotational correction. And this can allow us to more accurately achieve what we set out to achieve. It also can be used in actually planning. So we could plan off our CT images in the way that I will show you slightly later in the presentation, or we can go straight to CT and design what we want on the CAD software. And finally, what CT with the 3D modelling and the virtual CAD software allows us to do is we can actually then print up custom designed cutting and reduction guides for that individual. Okay. So what we would have here is guides that we would place onto the bone with K wires or Ellis wires, and we can cut along here. So this gives us a guide to make the osteotomy in exactly the right position and exactly the orientation that we have decided. When that is done, you can then remove the guide, place your new reduction guide that then lines up your K wires exactly how you wanted it to be, so that you've corrected the bone to the degree of angular and rotational deformity that you plan. And then you can hold that in position here, as you can just about see. And you can see where the osteotomy was, that it's slightly offset there, as you then place your implant. So this means that we can be more accurate with our cut and with our reduction. So how do we assess the deformities? We've examined the dog, we've taken our images, whether it's radiographs or CT, we've decided this dog needs surgery. So how do we go around assessing the deformities? There's six deformities, if you like, in the three different planes. So we have the frontal plane, where we would look at the dog from the front, okay? And so that, if you like, is from a cranial to caudal radiograph. And we will assess medial lateral deviation of bones. So that's valgus or varus. So valgus is where you have a lateral deviation, and varus is where you have a medial deviation. We can then move on to the sagittal plane, and we're really looking at the dog from the side, if you like, and that is a lateral to medial radiograph, and that allows us to look at pro and recurvatum. Okay, so procurvatum is where you have a cranial bow in the bone, and recurvatum is where you have a caudal bow. And finally, if it was really possible, we'd look at the transverse plane. So if you think about on a limb, a transverse plane is us looking straight up the leg. So you need an axially directed radiographic beam. Okay, so a beam that went from the distal end of the bone all the way up to the proximal end of the bone. And that would allow us to assess torsional deformity. In actual fact, that really is very difficult to achieve as a radiograph, but it's one of the benefits of CT because we can manipulate the image when we've got a 3D reconstruction in the software and then turn it in to look at it as in a transverse plane. The important thing is to remember that the deformity described in terms of the distal portion, okay, and its relationship to the proximal. So if we talk about valgus, if we talk about carpal valgus, okay, or a distal antebrachial valgus in these antebrachial deformities, that means that the distal portion is bent laterally. So when you talk about carpal valgus, that's the distal portion of the limb is deviated laterally, and opposite for varus. So that's the conventional way of naming these deformities. So we know what we're looking at in the three different planes. We know what we're going to call it, okay? But how do we assess what is normal for that limb? And there's a few sort of basic principles here. We have the bone axis, we have joint orientation lines and joint orientation angles. So the bone axis is just a straight line that goes down the bone, and that can be either just termed as an anatomic bone axis or a mechanical. So anatomic bone axis goes down the center of the medullary cavity, okay? So if you have a nice straight bone, you can draw one anatomic bone axis from the proximal joint to the distal joint. But many of the bones are curved, so the anatomic has to be a curved line. Okay. In actual fact, what would happen is that that's put into a number of straight segments. The mechanical bone axis doesn't go down the center of the bone. It goes where we think the mechanical axis of that bone is. And for example, in the tibia, it would go from your intercondylar eminences in the stifle, so that midpoint where you have the little triangles in the tibial plateau down to the middle of the tibiotarsal joint, okay? And that's what we describe as a mechanical bone axis because that's what we think of as the weight-bearing axis. So what axis is used to assess limb alignment depends on that individual bone and what plane you're looking at it in, okay? The joint orientation lines are taken as you can see in this image as red lines across the joint. Okay, so these intersect two known points in a joint, and they vary from joint to joint, and that can be checked in textbooks. Okay, and your bone axes, so the line that you would have coming down the bone, okay, and your orientation lines will give you the joint orientation angle. All right, so that where the axis intersects the orientation line, you have an angle. All right, now when you do this, we will measure off the unaffected limb to see what the orientation angle is for that individual dog. Or there are some reference values for different dogs. And this is the starting point of how we would assess what the limb alignment is. We'll talk a bit more about that when we come on to talk about the CORA principles. So we've had our images, we've checked for the limb alignment. We're going to think about doing some corrective surgery. Okay, so the principles of that corrective surgery is we want to restore joint congruity. It's the joint subluxation that will lead to degenerative joint disease, and osteoarthritis. So ideally, We want to put the joint back together so it fits together nicely. Now, that isn't always possible, okay? But that would be our number one aim. Then we want to put the paw back to a functional position so that the animal weight bears on its digits in a more normal fashion. Everyone will have seen the dogs with antebrachial deformities that weight bear on the second digit, okay, rather than all four. So we want to improve joint congruity and put the paw back to its functional position. And that can happen by correction of a rotational deformity or the angular deformity. And as I said to you before, the rotational deformity is often the more significant. And the final thing that we might wish to do is restore limb length. Okay. Now, that is difficult to achieve and not always necessary. So it would actually be pretty rare that we would think about that, but it is a consideration in the choice of surgery that we would end up doing. So what types of surgeries do we have? Many, and the optimal surgery depends on the degree of the deformity and the age of the dog. So if the dog's really quite young and has significant growth potential, we could manipulate that growth to try and alter how and sort of self-correct the deformity. If the degree of deformity is too big for that, and or the dog is too old, i.e. there isn't much growth potential left, then we have to reposition that bone. So we have to cut it and reposition it in a new position. And that can be done by an osteotomy, which is just a cut in the bone, or an ostectomy, where we actually remove a portion of bone. If we think about manipulation of growth, a simple method of that is a distal ulnar ostectomy. So in this case, this is a large Irish Wolfhound. We have a CT image here, and you can't really see it in the radiographs, but this on the CT, but this dog had a retained cartilaginous core, so the distal ulnar physis had stopped growing and was beginning to close. And because 85% of the growth of the ulna is done by the distal physis, if that stops growing, it has huge effects on a dog's growth. In addition, this is a giant breed dog with huge growth potential, so you can get a real problem, and you end up with radial procurvatum, radial torsion, valgus, carpal valgus. So when this dog was quite young, about 5 months of age, a distal ulnar ostectomy was done, as can be seen in the radiograph on the right. Large piece of bone is removed, and that removes the bowstring effect of the ulna not growing and allows the deformity to progress less. Okay, it won't correct what is already there, but the progression will be less. We then have a proximal ulnar ostectomy. So if you have an older dog but with still some growth potential, okay, we could do a proximal ulnar ostectomy. And in this case, we have, this is a basset hound that has short ulna syndrome. Okay, and you have significant subluxation of the elbow, significant what's called humeral ulnar incongruence. And what's been done in this case is a proximal ulnar ostectomy by oblique, so in two planes. And what that allows is that decouples the radius and the ulna, so the radius can continue to grow itself without the bowstring effect of the ulna. But because the dog is older, there's less elasticity of the interosseous ligament. So to improve joint incongruence, we have to release just the proximal portion of the ulna. And what happens is over time, as the dog weight bears, it's weight bearing predominantly on the radius and pushes that down and allows the ulna to itself realign back into a reasonable position. The final method that we can manipulate growth is we can actually do a transfarseal bridge or staple. So in this case, this is another wolfhound that had a retained cartilaginous core. Retained cartilaginous core in the ulna. So that the distal physis of the ulna has closed, it's not growing as much. That's having this huge effect on the radius. The radius is continuing to grow, and to do so, we're beginning to get a procurvatum on it, the curve. You can see you're getting a valgus deformity, and we're also getting a rotational deformity. We compare that to the contralateral limb, where you can see less of a procurvatum on the radius and no sort of angular or rotational deformity in that plane. So in this instance, what we've done is we've done a distal ulnar ostectomy, removed a large portion of the ulna, and then placed screws with a with sort of tension band wire. And the idea there is that we can limit the growth on the inside and the dorsal portion of the physis and allow the caudal physis and the lateral physis to continue to grow to some degree and hopefully over time straighten the leg. And if we look at the radiograph here, this radiograph is 6 weeks later. The ulna is basically healed, okay. But if we look, we've got a really nice straight radiograph of the elbow, and you've got a fairly straight radiograph of the carpus, which we didn't have before. Fairly straight elbow radiograph, but the carpus is rotated and deviated to the side. So we have a significant improvement just by transphyseal bridging in this case. We then think about if we're going to divide and reposition the bone, there's a number of osteotomies and ostectomies that we can do. We have an opening wedge osteotomy, which starts with just a transverse osteotomy, and then we open it up into a wedge. Okay. Now, the bonus of this is that you actually have some increase in limb length. The downside of it is that we have very little cortical bone contact, so you have an unstable osteotomy that requires quite significant fixation. Then have the opposite, where we have a closing wedge ostectomy, and what we'd actually do in this case is we will cut out a wedge of bone, and then you close that wedge. So the bonus of a closing wedge ostectomy is when you take out the wedge and you close it, you have good cortical bone contact almost all the way round. The disadvantage of a closing wedge ostectomy is that you decrease limb length even further to a degree. A whole bunch of other oblique, we have an oblique osteotomy, which is just an osteotomy at an angle. This would not often be done. We have the segmental ostectomy, as we described before, where we just take out a bit of bone, and we do that most commonly in the ulna. what's called a stair step lengthening osteotomy. This would be rarely done, but has been done, for example, in the radius, where you would make an osteotomy across to the sort of middle of the bone, straight down, and then back out the other side, and then pull the bone apart and hold it there with screws and then a plate. As I say, the idea is there that you've lengthened the bone acutely. Then have a radial osteotomy. Again, not commonly performed for normal sort of angular limb deformities, but a very common procedure in Cruciate disease. This, we have a TPLO radiograph, and this is a radial osteotomy, an example of a radial osteotomy. And if you like, this is an angular correction. Okay, we're altering the joint orientation line of the tibial plateau. Then there's dome osteotomies, and dome osteotomies are done with a special curved saw, and you take out this sort of curved part of bone, and that's in two planes. And when you put these two ends together, you can rotate them around, but by maintaining quite a lot of bone contact. But it only really works in one plane. So the actual efficacy of this is a little bit unknown. So I said to you, we've taken our images, we need to know what type of surgery we will do and how much of a correction we will actually make. And we use the center of rotation of angulation method for that, so the so-called CORA. So what happens is the CORA defines the apex of the deformity. So the CORA tells you exactly where the deformity is in a bone. And there might be multiple CORAs in a bone. We can have one, two, three more. And every CORA has a location where it is in the bone, a plane, whether it's the frontal plane, the sagittal plane, the transverse plane. As can be seen in this radiograph, this is a cranial caudal image of the antebrachium. So we have a CORA based in the distal radial metaphysis, and that's in the frontal plane. And its magnitude is its degree. So how much of a degree deformity do we have? Now to work out the CORA, okay, we go back to the principles of the joint orientation line, the axes, and the joint orientation angles. Okay, that's got to be defined for normal bones. So we would do that based on the unaffected limb, which is why it's important to take radiographs of that, or on reference values that we already have. So if we take this dog has a deformity here. So we have carpal valgus, if you like, a valgus deformity. Okay. So define where the CORA is and the magnitude of it. We need to first draw our lines. So our joint orientation lines for the elbow and the carpus. Okay. And then we're going to have our bone axes. Okay. Now, the bone axis, the orientation angle for where we start out, is defined from the normal bone on the other side, or reference angles, which you can get in the textbooks. So we work out the angle that we need. We can draw an axis down the bone, and we can do that from both sides. Okay, so we can do it from the proximal joint, and we do it from the distal joint. Where these two axes transect, that is the CORA. Okay, so, and it's got to transect within the bone. Okay, so here it's transected within the bone. So this is the CORA, and we can measure its location, i.e. how far it is away from the joint, and we can also measure its angle. So when we, if we were to correct that, what angular correction do we need to do so that these axes are the same? We have collinearity of the axes. Okay. If we do that, and you need to do that for both planes that you can do on a radiograph. So you need to do it in the frontal plane, as in this radiograph, and then you then take it onto the medial lateral radiograph and do the same. And if you have angulation in both those orthogonal planes, you have an oblique plane deformity. Okay. That gets very, very complex. If your deformity is so great, or you have more than one, you can see here where the axes don't intersect or would never intersect in the bone. So we have our joint orientation line. We've worked out the joint angles, joint orientation angles, to allow us to draw the axes here and here, and they are never going to meet. So what we do is we join these axes together with an intermediate anatomic axis that goes down the center of the bone, okay, and that allows us to find, and in this case we have two cora's. You have a proximal cora and a distal cora, and each cora has its own magnitude and location. This is often the case. So these are called biapical deformities because you've got two apexes of deformities. Okay, and this is one of the most common presentations. The difficulty comes about that these bones are often tiny. So if you wanted to correct this, the ideal way of correcting it would be to perform a corrective osteotomy at each cora. But that can be very, very difficult. In some cases, not possible. So when we decide to make an osteotomy to reposition that bone, generally we're going to be doing an opening wedge osteotomy or a closing wedge osteotomy. As I said before, we would normally try to do a closing wedge osteotomy or closing wedge osteotomy, so that we have good cortical bone contact and a more robust repair. And ideally, the osteotomy has to be at the cora. So you want to make the osteotomy down here at the cora. Okay. The problem is that it's next to the joint. It's juxta articular. Okay. So that means that we have a very small distal bone fragment to get fixation on. So often it's impossible to perform the osteotomy at the site of the cora because they're very close to the joint because they're due to premature closure of the growth plate. And what we don't want to do is we don't want to cause what's called translation if we can avoid it. Translation is where we move the proximal and distal bone side to side, whether that's in the frontal plane, so medial to lateral, or whether that's in the sagittal plane and it's cranial to caudal. Ideally, we don't want to get translation, although again, that isn't always possible. And there's a number of rules that the sort of human god of corrective osteotomies came up with, Dror Paley. He did a lot of work, an American guy, but did a lot of work in Russia with some of the sort of people that pioneered corrective osteotomies and distraction osteogenesis. And basically, he came up with three rules. If you make the osteotomy at the site of the cora, and that's where you hinge it, so you twist round from where you've made your osteotomy, you'll end up that these two bone axes will be in line with each other. So collinearity. Okay. If, as in B, you make your osteotomy at a different site than the cora and your hinge axis, okay, you can achieve collinearity of your bone axis, which is what you want, but you'll get some translation of the bone. You've had to move it over to the side. Okay. If you make the osteotomy, as in C, away from the cora, so the cora's here, we make the osteotomy down here, but we hinge it from here, as you can see, you don't have the same level of translation of the bone, but you have translation of your bone axes. Okay? So your bone axes do not join up. They do not have collinearity, and this is what you want to avoid. So it doesn't matter that you have a little bit of bone translation here. You don't want translation of the axes. You want the bone axes to meet up and be one single line. So how do we fix it after we've made these osteotomies? Two methods, internal fixation, external fixation, really. We think about internal fixation, that gives us rigid stabilization of an acute correction. So this is one of the cases from earlier, the wolfhound that had the ulnar osteotomy but no transfyseal bridging. The deformity unfortunately corrected, so we needed to do an acute correction of the radius. That's been made and it's been stabilized with a dorsal plate and a medial plate. Okay, so we've got very rigid fixation of that surgery. All right. That can be tricky because the coras are often juxta-articular. So if you made your osteotomy in exactly the right place, you might not have enough bone stock to get a plate on. And there's no ability to alter the correction post-operatively. When you've made your osteotomy and you put your plates on, that's it. That's the correction done. External skeletal fixation has some advantages over bone plates, because if we were to use like a hybrid fixator, which has a circular component and linear connecting bars, or a circular fixator, they can be altered post-operatively, and we can plan to alter them by putting in all sorts of fancy motors, etc. With circular fixators as well, you can perform distraction osteogenesis. So that's actually where we'll pull, you know, with the motors, pull the circular ESF apart and induce bone to grow in the gap and actually lengthen the limb. So these are advantages of external skeletal fixation. But the major problems are they have a mechanical disadvantage compared to bone plates. They are not as stiff or strong. So you end up having to tend to use very complex constructions, okay? And they have frequent complications. External fixators have a much higher complication rate than bone plates. So it's fairly rare that I would use them, but you can, okay? This is a case with an external fixator on it. We saw the radiograph earlier. You can see a fairly true radiograph of the elbow, but the carpus is basically almost at 90 degrees, whereas post-surgery, the elbow again pretty straight, and the carpus is more into a normal position. You can see all the metacarpals individually, and we have a circular fixator to hold it in position. There's different ways of determining the degree of correction you can do. Some people will eyeball it. That can be very wrong. We will measure it. So we'll actually measure on a radiograph or a CT We'll measure exactly where we're going to make the osteotomy, measure the distance from joints. We will measure the angle, and therefore by knowing the angle and on the size of the bone, we can measure the length of the osteotomy that we're going to make, for a closing wedge osteotomy, for example. That can be very accurate. But it's difficult when you have multiple corrections, etc. to do. Sometimes what we will do is use K-wires. So what we can actually do is place K-wires in parallel to the joints, above and below. We can make our osteotomy, and then we're just going to make those K-wires parallel. And they can even be used to help hold it temporarily until you put your definitive stabilisation on. More and more now, what we will do is use cutting guides. Okay, so from the CT and the CAD software, we can make these cutting design guides that will actually guide us on the orientation, the magnitude of the osteotomy or the osteotomy that we're going to make. If we look at a case of the sort of most one of the more common forms of angular limb deformity, this is little Charlie. He's a 2-year-old male neutered Shih Tzu. You can see by his muzzle that he could be difficult to handle. But he had bilateral short ulna syndrome, okay, but he had a progressively worsening lameness of the right hand, and the right thoracic limb. And what you can see here is that he has carpal hypoextension. So the carpus is kind of buckling over on itself, and he's almost knuckling onto his foot. And he was also walking on the inner digits. So he had a significant deformity of his antebrachium. And when you examined him, he had the lameness, really difficulty walking. He had exercise intolerance because he didn't want to go very far because it was so difficult for him. And he had elbow and carpal pain. Imaging showed he had elbow osteoarthritis, so we took a pre-op CT. We made it into the 3D reconstructions. If you look, this is looking from the inside of the leg, if you like. So this is like a medial lateral radiograph. You have severe procurvatum of the radius. We have torsion and valgus of the radius. What we did with this is put it into the software, made our cutting guides and reduction guides. So during the operation, we place a guide on with the K-wires. We are then able to make our cut across the bone, and then the cutting guide is taken off, and then the reduction guide is slipped over the K-wires, and that holds the bone in position, in its new position that we've decided, until we were able to put the dorsal plate on in position. We then take post-op CT, which allows us again better analysis of what's going on. We can do fancy reconstructions to better see the software and the hardware. So we can see where we have our plate and the screws, where we have our ulnar osteotomy, and then here we had the radial osteotomy. And already we can see we've had some correction of the procurvatum, although that's the thing we're least worried about. We were able to get true medial lateral image of the elbow, and we're getting a pretty good medial lateral image of the carpus, the metacarpals. Same, we have our pretty good CC image of the elbow and a CC of the carpus. So although there is still deformity in this dog's leg, it is much better than it was before. This is him the day after surgery, so weight bearing on the limb, and you can see he has no further carpal hypoextension. He's standing on his four digits rather than just the inner two. Still a little bit of carpal valgus. As I said, we can never correct these 100%. Then 8 weeks follow-up down the line. The radiographs, there's no healing of the ulna, which is not unexpected, especially in an adult dog. But we've got good healing of the radial ostectomy and its remodeling. Again, you can see a little bit. You've got some translation where we come down like this. It's not a problem, but the carpus is a fairly similar angle to the radii to the elbow. So happy with that outcome. The other thing that's really interesting is that we take these CTs and we do them, and they're not weight bearing, so it's a non-loaded image. So exactly the deformities we see may not be exactly the deformities that you see when they're weight bearing, and that's another level of complexity to these conditions. As with all surgeries, there can be complications, and these can be major surgeries. We're often making two approaches, we're making multiple cuts in bone. They can be time consuming, so problems that you can see are delayed or non-union. Implant complications, although that's less likely with modern implants, and if the owners do what they're told. Sepsis, infection, wound infections, implant associated infections can happen. Not that commonly, but they can. Big one is the failure to correct all the deformities. As I said to you, it's virtually impossible to give these dogs normal leg. We want to give them a functionally acceptable leg, and so we don't often correct all the deformities. But because it's so complex and we assess the deformities on non-loaded imaging, there are occasions when we seem to have done very little difference to the dog, although you know you've made a big change. So that's a problem. Progression of the deformities is possible. Now, that often happens if you try to manipulate growth, because we don't exactly know what manipulation we're going to achieve or how that dog is going to grow and what the progression would be anyway. And as I showed you in the image before, we have some large dogs that we will do surgery on when they're very young and don't need to repeat surgery, but there are some dogs that will need to have multiple surgeries before the correction can be achieved that you wish to achieve. And this is why it's very difficult to assess and know exactly what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. And not really a complication of the surgery, but something that must be talked about to the owners, is that these animals often inevitably get osteoarthritis, and which is inevitably progressive, regardless of what we do. So I hope that that's given you some ideas of what you need to do to assess dogs with angular limb deformities, and allow you to have some idea of what's possible to correct them. But as I say, the one thing that I cannot stress enough is that just because it's got a bent leg does not mean it needs correction. So I'd be happy to take any questions now. So there's a question just come in about whether we would, or how often we correct these multiple CORAs with multiple osteotomies. It's reported, but I would extremely rarely do that, because often the dogs, they have very small limbs. It's difficult enough to get the implants on and make the correction where you're doing. So the preferred method would be always to make one osteotomy. And there are ways that we can model these limbs to make one osteotomy and correct, multiple deformities. But that is getting very, very complex. There's some large human groups that look into how to do this with complex mathematical programming and algorithms. But it gets extremely complex. But if at all possible, we would want to make one osteotomy, do an acute correction, and stabilize it internally to minimize the complications. It's really important to remember that we're trying to improve the function of this dog, not give it a normal leg.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Scott for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.